Exxon workers tried blasting a strip of beach at Tonsina Bay with hot water. The goal was to loosen up the oil and suck it up with vacuums. But Exxon's Homer area supervisor, Glenn Raz, who watched the procedure, says it didn't work. He says the oil was like asphalt, and the Tonsina Beach wasn't suitable for that type of cleanup.
The beach we tested had from very fine gravel and sediments to hand-sized type rocks, and the fine sediment really held the oil in there, and it was literally saturated in there, so it did not want to give up the oil readily with the technique we applied.
Homer area representative for the Department of Environmental Conservation, Les Leatherberry, also watched Exxon's test of the hot water flushing. Leatherberry agreed it didn't do much, but he says Exxon didn't try hard enough.
My personal opinion is the implementation or the method they used to implement it at Tonsina was not as effective as it could have been. They could have done it slower, taken more time, been a little more organized, but I think that people had the opinion that the method wouldn't work and didn't spare very much to make sure that it accomplished the idea that they had.
Leatherberry says the test could have been improved by repeating the spraying two or three times, but that wasn't done. High-pressure hot water beach cleanup techniques are being used in Prince William Sound, but with limited success. Originally, Exxon's beach cleanup plans for the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula did not include mechanical methods, but Coast Guard officials later directed Exxon to try more than just rakes and shovels. Exxon's Glenn Raz says even though the hot water pressure spraying didn't work at Tonsina, they're still going to try the method again. He says they'll do a test on a beach that has larger rocks and see if it's effective there. The second test is planned for later this week when a landing craft that's needed for the job is available. Right now, Exxon officials say the LCM is busy doing honey bucket runs, cleaning out porta potties for the beach cleanup crews. In Homer, I'm Eileen Hughes.
Excerpts from the log of the Ms. Creant on her voyage to Prince William Sound, fall 1984. Day 1. As I peer through the pilot house windows at the drizzly gray mist, I know I'm in Prince William Sound. Even my pounding hangover can't deny the pristine wilderness, unfouled by tourists and containing only a smattering of environmentalists. My nostrils are assailed by the smell of mildew and a sour bilge, and my bleary eyes smart from the backdraft of a poorly tuned oil stove. I contemplate making a cup of instant coffee. Yeah, maybe with some whiskey. My reverie is shattered by a series of staccato explosions from Larry's Mini 14. I reel out into the early afternoon light to investigate. Larry had shot at, as he put it, a seal or something. He said he didn't know if he hit it or not. I explained that you shoot seals when they're looking away from you, so that they don't start their dive reflex when they see the gun's muzzle flash. Otherwise, they sink and you have to wait a few days for them to surface. Larry said we didn't want it anyhow, as they're illegal. I agreed. They got good livers, though. Oh, well. We had a beer instead. Day 3. Polar crab bot, baited with a seagull that Larry'd shot, full of undersized females, invited him to lunch. Later, Larry went ashore to hunt some ducks, took his 300 Savage, says it cleans them as it kills them. Take stock of larder, beer nearly gone. Larry returns empty-handed, concedes 300 Savage may be too large for duck, but waxes ecstatic about the puff of feathers a 300 grain bullet makes when it impacts. Had beer to celebrate. Ate crab. Day 4. Underway for Cordova, situation desperate. Through some oversight, we're understocked on cigarettes. Also out of beer. Whiskey holding out. Are making all speed for town. Sighted a pot of killer whale. Too far away for a good shot. Past several super tankers that are waiting to go into Valdez. Larry wants to pass close enough to moon him, told him maybe on the way out. day 9. Finally got out of Cordova after we got Larry's bail reduced. We passed close to the supertankers moored in the roads, exchanged obscene gestures. I'm impressed by their size from up close. The thought of all that crude oil in one place and the possibility of a spill is sobering. So, had a shot with our beer. Day 10, Montague Island. Went ashore this morning and shot my limit of deer, which is 5. Shot a couple of extra for Larry. Unfortunately, Larry did the same for me. Now I have 4 extra deer. Oh well. Pulled shrimp pot. It was full. Saw some otters. Didn't shoot at them. Even Larry's bloodlust is filled. Caught a halibut. Saw some whales, grays or fins or something. Life is everywhere here. So many animals and so little ammo. Day 11. Head for home. Larry is disappointed he didn't kill a bear. Oh well.
And the fine sediment really held the oil in there. It was literally saturated in there, so it did not want to give up the oil readily with the technique we applied.
I think that people had the opinion that the method wouldn't work and didn't spare very much to make sure that it accomplished the idea that they had.
Many of the communities that are affected in Kodiak Island Borough, Kenai Borough, cities of Homer, Seward, Valdez, and I suspect Cordova also have bonds outstanding and may be in a position to want to market some additional bonds. What's this doing to our credit ratings? They identified, for instance, a tax problem that we will have all the communities as these fishing periods and units are shut down. That will negatively affect fish tax, and the fish tax is shared back with the cities and boroughs.
It's an important step for opponents of drilling in Bristol Bay. Fishermen actually wanted more, for the government to buy the leases back. So did Governor Steve Cooper, but all are pleased that the committee took the action they did.
This vote shows that somebody out there is listening to us. This is a victory in a subcommittee. We're going to have to make our case again before the full committee, as well as before the full Congress and in the Senate as well. But it shows that people recognize how vulnerable Bristol Bay is to a potential oil spill, and I hope we are able to win this one all the way down the line. A one-year moratorium isn't a total victory, but it's certainly moving in the direction that we want.
If ultimately approved, the moratorium would bar any exploration of the leases through the fall of 1990. Since nothing's planned for this summer, any development of the bay would be set back for at least 2 fishing seasons. The idea of a buyback of the leases is not dead, however. In their bill, the subcommittee asked the Interior Department to look at the matter. There never has been a federal buyback of leases before, though, and some wonder where the money would come from. But California Congressman George Miller has said his Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Committee would propose buyback legislation for the Sale 92 leases, citing the need to protect the renewable resources of Bristol Bay. The main opponent to the idea, however, is Alaska Congressman Don Young, who not only opposes a buyback, but was even against a moratorium. Young says further limits on domestic oil production are a threat to national security. Republicans on the Appropriations Subcommittee attempted to delete the Bristol Bay moratorium from the bill, but were defeated by the overwhelming support for the idea from the state, local residents, and fishermen. Given the controversial nature of the proposal, the moratorium's chances before the full Appropriations Committee next week is not a sure bet. Its fate in the Senate will depend on the support of Stevens and Murkowski. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
The senior senator from Alaska welcomes the idea of a one-year moratorium, but not the buyback. This is Steve Heimel in Anchorage. Senator Ted Stevens calls it a cooling-off period and says it's needed because this is not the proper political climate in which to be making delicate decisions about oil drilling. But the senator says he's not so sure about buying back $95 million worth of leases.
I don't know. I think we ought to think about this next year and take a look at the report of the Secretary of Interior. I'm unwilling to make a commitment now that in any event, I would seek money to get those leases back if it meant coming out of some of the things we have to do, salmon research, the development of a greater hatchery, you know, production, the whole area of fisheries is what you're talking about in terms of money that comes out of that section of the bill. There is a ceiling on those bills right now, and if we have to pay out $95 million, it's going to come out of something. Now, that's unfortunate but true.
Senator Stevens spoke to reporters on a conference call that had been scheduled to announce the passage of his oil spill bill in the Senate Conference Committee. Reporters were more interested in his reaction to the House Interior Appropriations Committee action. Stevens says he's still sitting on the fence on another item the governor requested, a delay in drilling in the Chukchi Sea, where Shell Western wants to explore this summer.
I don't know what's going to happen to Chukchi Sea. I've not taken any position about its delay so far. I think that's an exploration situation, summertime drill ship with a contingency plan barge and emergency equipment there. I think that's as safe as we can get, but we'll have to take a look at that.
On his own legislation, the senator said it's pretty much the same bill he introduced in May, giving the Coast Guard authority to manage large spills, stiffening pilot requirements, requiring new spill contingency plans for ports and for each tanker, and paying for research on spill impacts. But it's been amended with the ideas of other senators to make it a more national measure.
As they've studied it, and we've had three hearings, other senators said, you know, this ought to be a national law, not just affecting Prince William Sound. And when you see the bill, you'll see that it's just our bill expanded to cover the national impact where that's appropriate.
Some in the Senate want to strengthen the bill significantly. Senator Slade Gorton of Washington, for instance, wants to punish companies responsible for oil spills by taking away their profits for that year. Stevens says amendments like that would slow the progress of the bill from a July target date for a Senate floor vote.
Without regard to whether he's right or wrong, and several senators expressed interest in the concept of having a penalty involved that's greater for the spilling of oil, I think that we'll not accept that amendment because we want the bill to be passed without going to another committee.
Senator Stevens says another controversy involves how large the pipeline liability fund ought to be. The bill would increase it from $248 million to $750 million. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
The program stresses three areas: prevention of oil spills, quick response, and research. In prevention, the industry is calling for mandatory participation in the Coast Guard's advisory vessel traffic systems for tankers and tougher federal qualifications for ship pilots. The industry also calls for wider Coast Guard authority in alcohol and drug testing. On vessels, updated alarm systems and ship-specific contingency plans would be required. For response, the industry proposes a nationwide oil spill network. Mobile Oil Head Alan Murray.
The industry can seriously, significantly enhance its response capability by providing greater availability of equipment and trained manpower through a petroleum industry response organization, which we will call PIRO. PIRO would have a headquarters group. The suggested location would be to Washington, D.C., and five regional response centers.
PIRO's main job would be contracting equipment to help contain and clean up spills. It would also keep a data bank listing things like the location of spill response equipment. The five response centers would run around the clock with personnel and resources at hand to tackle a 30,000-ton spill. Startup costs for the PIRO system are estimated at $70 to $100 million. After that, annual costs would be up to $35 million. All that would be paid for by the industry through a charge on marine transport of crude oil to U.S. ports. But despite the industry funding, the federal government would manage spills. Alan Murray says management should be in the hands of the Transportation Secretary and the U.S. Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard is better positioned than industry members to provide a consistent nationwide approach and resolve diverse interests at various levels of government. The Coast Guard has a presence along the whole coast and is a military command structure.
The final part of the program is objective research aimed at issues such as whether the industry should use double-hulled tankers, as well as developing better containment and recovery methods and equipment. Up to $35 million would go to research over the next 5 years. Under the program, the nearest regional response center to Alaska would be in Seattle. Murray says there's no need for a full-time Alaska presence.
In Alaska, the owners of the Alyeska Pipeline Company are providing an improved spill response facility that could receive additional support from the Piro centers if needed.
Murray defends the program against charges that it should have been done a long time before the Exxon Valdez accident.
I think it was merely felt. It was brought home to us that we had to do it at a high level, we had to move it quickly, and we had to make quick decisions. And so we put the best brains in the world on this matter and came up with it. And I think it's a good program, and I hope all governments support it.
But even as the industry announced its program, a U.S. Senate committee was marking up legislation that demands some tougher standards of the oil industry. For example, tankers would be required to have containment equipment and personnel who know how to use it. The industry opposes that, saying it could be too dangerous. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
If you believe, for example, that there is long-term ecological damage that cannot be repaired, you've essentially sold off a piece of your natural resource beauty for cash.
Economist Andrew Sapphire spoke to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. He says he doesn't think there are any long-term positive effects of the oil spill on Alaska's economy.
The money involved here will be relatively short-term. It will percolate through the economy through the summer. It should be pretty well out of circulation by late this year.
Sapphire says the short-term has everyone excited, with lots of money spent directly into the system. And that money has what economists call a high multiplier. If money is paid once, say, to an employee, then turned around to pay that person's rent, then turned around again by the landlord to pay the mortgage on the building, it is used 3 times, and it has a multiplier of 3. A lot of Alaska money has a low multiplier because it quickly goes to pay bills out of state. But the oil spill cleanup money will change a lot of hands before it leaves the state or loses its positive energy on the Alaska economy.
You've had massive direct spending in the state by a company that is virtually a government unto itself. That has had a very high multiplier effect that has percolated up the coast and up through the interior in terms of spending.
It is the long term that has Sapphire worried. He writes a column for the Alaska Business Monthly that sometimes requires him to look into the future. But he says he never makes forecasts past about 12 or 18 months. He can see boat owners in Prince William Sound making their payments easily this year, as he says most are making more money than if they had fished. But it is next year's fishing season that is still cloudy in the crystal ball.
The question is, once the sympathy and the outpouring of cash decline over the next year, what will the fish look like?
If the long-term damage of the spill can't be repaired, Sapphire says Alaska has basically sold its resources for cash. If the damage can be repaired, it's like the resources were rented out. Sapphire thinks the state will probably get a fair price for the lost resources, but he says it may not make up for the fact that Alaska was never a willing seller. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
Getting contributions mailed in. any donation at all mailed to our company, which co-funded this recording, Easterling Enterprises in Charlotte, North Carolina. Any donation whatsoever, and you'll receive a copy of this cassette, plus a commemorative picture of our producer, Captain Slick Nazelgood.
Well, it's all right, even if you turn.
On the behalf of the Sierra Club in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Spielberries wanted to do something special and get people sort of excited about the idea that there is a group that does care about traveling across America and spending our summer in efforts to raise as much money as we can for the wildlife. Our producer, Captain Slick Nazelgood, is actually handling that, and of course we have a hard time keeping him awake and so forth, but he does, between drinks, he does make several phone calls, and right now we don't really have a schedule lined up, but we would hope that we could possibly leave and have our tour completed sometime in maybe the middle of June, and we think that it might run as possibly as long as up until September the 15th, which is I believe it's the deadline for the Exxon people to have this all cleaned up.
When you're still waiting at the end of the line.
Scientists are confident the disposal plan poses no threat to marine life. Fishermen don't dispute that. They're more worried about the perception the public will have if oiled fish are returned to the fishing grounds. But Greenpeace Regional Director Cindy Lowry says she is concerned about the impact to marine life, specifically marine mammals.
Yeah, I think there's the potential for really violating the Marine Mammal Protection Act as far as stellar sea lions and other marine mammals are involved because, as you know, dumping oiled fish back into the water could have potential harm to the mammals and therefore would constitute a take under the Marine Mammal Protection Act since it would be not only harmful but harassment as well.
But does the plan pose a threat to marine mammals? It depends, according to Lloyd Lowry of the Department of Fish and Game. Lloyd Lowry is chairman of a team studying the effect of oil on marine mammals in Prince William Sound.
Well, we certainly do know that species like stellar sea lions will follow around trawl boats and hang out around canneries, and they will eat waste fish and discarded fish from the boats or from the canneries. So there is a possibility that if these contaminated fish are dumped into the ocean, that sea lions may be attracted and may eat some of those fish. It would also be possible that killer whales and harbor seals would be similarly attracted to this free food and perhaps eat some of the contaminated discards.
Lowry says it's hard to evaluate how big of a problem it might be, not knowing how much fish will be dumped or how badly contaminated it'll be. EPA maintains the amount of dumping will be minimal and the level of contamination microscopic. It takes just one oiled fish in a load for the whole catch to be ground up and dumped. But Greenpeace says even a small amount of contamination is too much.
I know people think that, at least some people think that the amount of fish would be minimal, and that's not really clear in the permit. It doesn't talk about any sort of tonnage cap or anything like that that they could take. And I also think that people have to start considering the cumulative impacts that, you know, well, people are saying, you know, Exxon, that, well, this is just one little thing, one little time that we'll do, and, you know, all these one little things, one little times mount up, and the cumulative impact can have, you know, really devastating effects on marine resources.
Fish and Game's Lloyd Lowry says tests have been conducted showing low levels of oil can adversely affect marine mammals.
Because marine mammals can metabolize hydrocarbons, and they metabolize those hydrocarbons in the liver, and then they excrete those hydrocarbons through the kidneys. So that the good part of that is that they don't tend to accumulate large levels of hydrocarbons in the tissues because they've been processed and excreted. The bad part of that is that there's a certain amount of damage done to the organs that break down and excrete the hydrocarbons.
But Lowry says the effects of short-term, low-level exposures look to be reversible.
So based on that limited information, I'd say that this is not likely to become an acute problem if it's just a batch or two of lightly contaminated fish and it's not dumped in an area where there's a large number of sea lions or some other species waiting there to feed on them.
According to Carl Lautenberger of the EPA, oiled fish dumping was done during the Glacier Bay spill and they had no problems with it. In any case, he says the Department of Environmental Conservation would keep an eye on the whole process and Exxon's permit could be modified if necessary. At the very least, Greenpeace will try to get Exxon's permit modified so no dumping could occur near marine mammals. Cindy Lowry says what they really want is to get the permit revoked. But first, Greenpeace and Kodiak fishing representatives are going to talk the issue over with Exxon. At a meeting Wednesday night in Anchorage, Exxon will be asked to consider other alternatives to dumping, such as barging the waste to the lower 48 or getting a processor on Kodiak to agree to freeze it. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The point at which we find ourselves is as important as any in the hours or days that follow the spill. That is whether we're going to do a simple accounting of man hours and count bird carcasses or consider the totality of the loss.
The Exxon Valdez is scheduled to weigh anchor at 6 a.m. Friday. 20 days later, it should arrive in San Diego. There's no crude oil left on the tanker. She is carrying diesel fuel, however. Her engines will be used within Prince William Sound and again as she approaches San Diego when greater maneuverability is required. The crew on board will also have the option of starting the engines in rough seas. The rest of the time, two tugs will be doing the work with another pair following in case they are needed. Exxon says the vessel has been declared seaworthy by three independent organizations, the Coast Guard, the American Bureau of Shipping, and Exxon. In addition, the State Department of Environmental Conservation says there is no oil remaining in the punctured tanks that could leak into the sea. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
There are hundreds to thousands of fish swimming around inside the tanks that had been pierced by Bligh Reef, and he referred to them as schools of fish, and he said there was ample flora and fauna there to suggest that it was very clean.
There are a number of important scientific studies that were supposed to be conducted this summer have, for some reason, totally unknown to us, been canceled and put on hold. And our view is, what can we learn from this tragedy so that in the future we will have gone in and done the proper kinds of assessments and we will truly understand the impacts on an ecosystem like Prince William Sound.
On Wednesday, four boats went out in the inlet for a test fishery. Fish and Game biologist Paul Roosh says the fishermen didn't get any oil on their gear and they didn't catch any oiled fish. But he says they did see blobs of oil in the middle of the inlet.
It was collection of large tarballs, football-sized tarballs, floating along the rip there. That's about it. That's all we saw. Well, I'm sure there's more of it out there than what you can see.
Under the state's zero-tolerance policy, a fishing area is supposed to be shut down if there's an appreciable likelihood of oil fouling gear or fish. Roo says the policy is open to some interpretation, and if oil is found in one area, it doesn't mean that all of the upper inlet would have to be shut down. With the season slated to open on Monday, fishermen are wondering if or where they're going to be able to fish. But Roosh says no decisions have been made yet. He says it's all under discussion, and the department will make an announcement on Saturday.
I think people, as they wait here, and I can very much sympathize with everything kind of being up in the air at this point, but I think the best thing anybody can do right now is just get ready to go fishing, and because we simply can't give any direction at this point which way this will go.
Whatever happens, fishermen know that they're not looking at what you'd call a normal season. The options seem to be dodging tarballs, fishing in restricted areas, or not fishing at all. As for restricted areas, fishermen don't like it because it means more boats squeezed into smaller areas. Fisherman Wesley Humbird.
Well, I don't think we should be restricted to partial openings. Either we have it open all or not. I think it's either close it down or let us fish, one or the other.
This isn't the first time Upper Cook Inlet fishermen have dealt with oil. In 1987, when the tanker Glacier Bay spilled oil in the inlet, there were some closures and restrictions, and fishermen have still not received compensation for their losses. The Upper Cook Inlet harvest this year was forecast at 2.5 million sockeye, which is a little above average. Aside from the almost 600 boats in the drift fleet, there are more than 700 set net sites. Reporting from Homer, I'm Eileen Hughes. The drift gillnet season is supposed to open on Monday, but the tarballs could mean restrictions or a closure for more than 500 boats in the fleet. Fish and game biologist Paul Roush says the blobs of oil were spotted in the middle of the inlet Wednesday during a test fishery.
It was a collection of large tarballs, football-sized tarballs, floating along the rip there. That's about it. That's all we saw. Well, I'm sure there's more of it out there than what you can see.
Under the state's zero-tolerance policy, a fishing area has to be shut down if there's a likelihood that oil could foul gear or fish. Roush says a decision on Monday's opening is expected on Saturday. In Homer, I'm Eileen Hughes.
Exxon officials left Valdez by boat at 3 o'clock this morning to make sure the Exxon Valdez got off safely on its journey to be repaired in San Diego. The weather is so foggy in Valdez that no planes or helicopters have been able to monitor the situation, but the Coast Guard just reported the tanker hulk left on schedule at 6:02 a.m.
The Alaska Housing Marketing Council heard from the governor's office about the terrible housing conditions in communities affected by the oil spill. Glenda Straube is the executive director of the council. She says Valdez seems to be coping with the housing shortage, but there are still too many people living in unsanitary conditions in Seward, Homer, and Cordova. The council suggested relocating mobile homes from Anchorage and Fairbanks to oil spill towns.
But the communities in those cities are very concerned about a bunch of mobile homes, you know, converging upon their town. And there's a real fear that, you know, it's never going to leave their town.
Straube says if there's not community support for the idea, it will be dropped. Another idea is to convince the Department of Housing and Urban Development to rent out vacant HUD homes in the communities. And Straube says the governor's office might ask the congressional delegation to put a little pressure on HUD to comply. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Ken Flory says the department's policy is that they can't allow fishing in areas where there's oil or where oil has been encountered during a test fishery. On Wednesday, several test fishing boats encountered tarballs in the middle and west rips of the inlet. So Flory says they decided to cancel the startup of the fishery.
So therefore, we're going to close until such time as either the oil clears or it sinks or it's picked up before we go out there and try to attempt to have a fishery.
Fishermen here weren't too surprised by the closure. They already knew the results of the test fishery, and they knew boats hired by Exxon had been dip netting up tarballs in the inlet for the past couple of weeks. Fisherman Forrest Tressler says he supports the decision to cancel the first opening.
If there's evidence that there's oil present, I don't think it's worth the risk to fish. I would rather see the fishery shut down and then take a risk of putting contaminated fish on the market.
The Department of Fish and Game will continue to test fish on a daily basis. A decision on the next scheduled opening, which would be Friday, June 30th, will be made the day before. Reporting from Homer, I'm Eileen Hughes.
The anchor on the Exxon Valdez is clear of the bottom. We're going to heave it right up. South Exxon, California, and forward, pulling forward. Guided by the Exxon Golden State. Made up fast on the stern of the Exxon Valdez. We'll begin our heading up to 241 degrees or a fist length up here from Naked Island.
It was 6 o'clock Friday morning when the Exxon Valdez weighed anchor. An hour later, she was moving, under tow at a stately 1.5 knots. She was also leaving a fresh sheen of oil in her wake. Assessments of the sheen's significance vary between the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Coast Guard. DEC says it was initially a recoverable sheen, diminishing to non-recoverable towards midday. Spokesman Robert Lute says he wants to know why it happened. The Coast Guard characterized it as very, very light and said it was not unexpected. Robert Lute reports Special Assistant to the Governor Ernie Piper saying the pollution came from the part of the Exxon Valdez where the cargo tanks are located. That would indicate it's from crude oil left over from before the spill. DEC certified the cargo tanks as being clean. Lute heard from their field personnel that the tanks were clean enough to pass the white glove test and that they were swarming with schools of fish. Inspecting the vessel for structural integrity was part of the Coast Guard's job. Regardless, DEC reports the oil stopped leaking early Friday afternoon. At that time, they had people sampling and monitoring the sheen, but no indication had been given whether an enforcement action would be launched. The Exxon Valdez is continuing on its way. In 20 days, they say it'll be in San Diego. That's where she started out, NASCO Shipyards, December 1986. The vessel's original price tag was $125 million. Estimates for repairs are $25 million. The cost of the salvage operation is unknown. In the words of salvage coordinator Paul Myers, all of the invoices aren't in yet. Exxon hasn't gotten the bill from the military, for instance. They helped move and pump the vessel, among a lot of other things. There will be the cost from 2.5 months of inspecting and repairing the hull. And there's the cost of figuring out if it is safe to tow the tanker down the west coast. Exxon's pretty sure it is. Myers says they've been conservative in all their calculations. Damage to the ship's hull has weakened her, but Myers doubts there's any danger she'll break up. The Coast Guard and the American Bureau of Shipping seem to agree. The tanker will spend most of the trip down about 100 miles off the coast. Myers says current wisdom is the waters are a little gentler out there, and people might be reassured if the Exxon Valdez is a goodly ways offshore. And, by the way, it was a beautiful morning in Prince William Sound. Gray sky, gray sea. We saw some otters near Naked Island. They were a welcome sight, almost as welcome as seeing the stern of the Exxon Valdez moving south. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
All of these areas are going to require a lot of information. Time is ticking away, and we don't think we ought to wait any longer to try to get some kind of agreement with all the various federal agencies involved. So we're going ahead on our own. Maybe we can sort this out later on, but we think it's very important that we get this information post-haste. The real question is how you assess the damage to a bird or to a sea otter. And that is something that the creativity of the American legal system no doubt wouldn't have any trouble with, but I can tell you that the various government agencies have a lot of trouble with it. What is a dead puffin worth? The Interior says it's worth $7. I don't know how they got that figure, but that's the sort of thing that we disagree with Interior on. As a matter of fact, the damage is still going on because the oil is still appearing in places where it hadn't been expected 2 or 3 months ago. So it's an ongoing job. We know that the quicker we begin to collect data and start doing the kind of work that we need to do to bolster our damage assessment, the better off we'll be. And, of course, we're all working against the weather. The weather will move in mid-September, 1st of October, and then it'll be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get the kind of information that we need.
It used to be called the Taipar Project, a group of people producing homemade boom made out of absorbent fabric. For legal reasons, the group had to quit using the name Taipar and now simply call the fabric geotextile material. Whatever you call it, geotextile may prove to be one of the most effective materials in oil cleanup. The group started producing homemade boom when the spill first hit Kodiak. Exxon paid for the fabric and put the crew on its payroll. Later, Exxon halted production and disbanded the group. One of the reasons being because Exxon had a huge stockpile of traditional boom that was no longer needed in Prince William Sound, and it didn't make sense to pay a local crew to produce more. Many in Kodiak considered the geotextile fabric superior to traditional materials. Locals pushed hard to get the crew reinstated. Exxon held firm, but the company did agree to turn over its stockpile of geotextile fabric to the Kodiak Island Borough. And that's where we are now. The work crew is back designing and constructing cleanup materials, which the borough is distributing. Coordinator Bridget Milligan says one of their projects is making beach covers, kind of like an absorbent pool cover.
We are making absorbent beach covers to go out to set netters and the villages to be, what these are for is they can tie them on to something secure on the beach, and they keep oil from floating, or, you know, so it won't refloat and contaminate another beach, or it'll keep the beach from being contaminated by new oil. And if you just lay it on a beach that has oil, it actually draws the oil out of the sand, especially on a hot day, and it just absorbs it and it keeps it and it hangs on to it.
The beach covers can be laid on the shore like a blanket. Once the material soaks up the oil, users pack the cover into a plastic bag and Exxon picks it up for disposal. The group has also been making scientific devices for the Department of Environmental Conservation. A lot of the oil around Kodiak is sinking oil, and sinking oil can't be seen in routine flight surveys. But geotextile devices placed throughout a bay can alert DEC to the presence of oil under the water. DEC's John Fazzato explains the devices, which are called monitors.
What they basically are, it's a cork line, and then it's surrounded by material, and it's sewed up, and then there's about a 12-inch curtain, 18-inch curtain underneath with a lead line on the bottom. And what it does, it sits on the water, and on really good days, it picks up the moose and the sheen that's in the water, and then when you fly over it, you can see where moose and sheen has come from.
The monitors are a new invention, just now being tested on the west side of the island, where the worst of the oil is. Fazzato says the monitors appear to be working well.
You know, everybody, the set netters are really happy with it. You know, they think it's really nice. And hopefully, you know, we're going to get some really good information out of them.
Monitors are currently in three bays. DEC will install more if the test devices prove useful. As for the beach covers, the Kodiak Island Borough is distributing the geotextile fabric free to any local set net fisherman or villager who can use it. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Exxon hopes to burn oily waste, things like driftwood, absorbent cleanup pads, and carcasses, the debris of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Incinerating the waste isn't the only option, but the State Department of Environmental Conservation thinks it's the best choice. Better to burn it on a barge than shipping it to port first. Better to burn it than transport it to a landfill. There are concerns over incineration, however. Much of the waste has been in salt water, which has chlorine. And, of course, it's been coated with crude oil hydrocarbons. John Sandstead is an environmental engineer for DEC.
Fortunately, we haven't found a very good database on establishing what exactly types of emissions might be. The concern is if any improper incineration of burning this or any other type of waste, there'd be products of incomplete combustion, and if were chlorinated waste, you know, there's a possibility of dioxin furan production. If you're talking about hydrocarbons, there's components like benzene that we want to make sure are completely destructive.
Before the incinerators can begin operation, they need a permit. Regulations, either state or national, don't specifically address a lot of things such an incinerator might emit, but Sandstead says proper burning will take care of many. He says the key factors are temperature and the length of time the gas is exposed to heat. He mentions 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit in 1 second. Before issuing a permit, DEC will require a test burning of oily waste. The results will be compared with predictions of the facility's performance. Modifications and further testing may be required. If the tests don't meet DEC's standards, they have the option of refusing to issue a permit. John Sandstead.
There were a real imminent threat to public health and the environment caused by smother emissions. We could invoke additional conditions or deny a permit based on those findings. But, you know, there we would have to feel pretty
Bill McClarence heads the South Central branch of DEC. He says there will be public hearings on the incinerators, probably within a couple of weeks, probably in Valdez and Anchorage. A public notice to that effect should be out in the next few days. The incinerator currently anchored at Knight Island has had some experience with public comment in the past. It belongs to the Sealy Corporation out of Ketchikan. The incinerator is of the silo type, typically used to burn wood waste. Some modifications have been made to it, but when the Sealy Corporation wanted to fire the incinerator up in Ketchikan, public outcry there persuaded him to abandon the project, so it was decided to barge it to Prince William Sound and do it here. The DEC's Bill McClarence has some doubts about the Sealy incinerator and its ability to handle the demands of oily waste.
The technology is totally unproven for any kind of material. I mean, even the wood waste burners are not operating adequately, and I think they're banned in several states.
A second barge-mounted incinerator is currently en route from Seattle. It, too, would have to go through the testing process before being allowed to operate. Permit applications have been received from a couple other companies as well. One is reportedly designed to recover waste plastics. If everything goes smoothly, it's conceivable that one of the barge-mounted incinerators could be in operation next month. That doesn't seem probable, however. John Sandstead says the summer could run out before they're online. In the meantime, the oily waste continues to pile up. Over 20,000 tons of the stuff, some of it, including birds and animals, is being burned in three smaller incinerators near the Valdez pipeline terminal. Some is being trucked to Anchorage, ground up and shipped to a landfill in Oregon. The rest of it is being stockpiled, mainly in plastic bags, mainly on barges. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
The Prince William Sound Users Association spill map is put out every Friday in a limited edition of 40. That's all they can afford. The color code is easy to understand. If it's red, it's oiled. If it's blue, it's not. Association Executive Director Rita Hendricks says, when you see the big picture, you can see there are still plenty of places to go.
You know, although there are some disastrous areas that have been hit with oil, there are quite a few areas that haven't been touched at all, which was really a pleasant surprise to me.
The map also shows areas where cleanup crews are at work. It's distributed to information centers, libraries, harbor masters, gear shops, and other places where boaters and kayakers are likely to gather. The map is paid for by the Prince William Sound Cleanup and Rehabilitation Fund. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
The July issue of Alaska Magazine is on the racks. It came out a week early because the June issue sold out in Alaska, and that's never happened before in the history of the magazine. With the tourist season in full force, the management didn't want Alaska Magazine rack standing empty. The bright photograph of a small plane flying over snow-capped mountains on the July cover is more traditional for the magazine than its June cover, a dark view of Prince William Sound and large yellow letters announcing Paradise Lost.
We told a story that was a very important story, the biggest story in Alaska, and we certainly, you know, it's unfortunate the story broke for tourism and that sort of thing, but we could not adjust the coverage of that story because of tourism.
When Alaska Magazine editor Ron Dalby decided to do the fairly extensive oil spill coverage in his tourist-oriented magazine, he couldn't have foreseen the controversy it would cause. Two large tour companies, Holland America and Princess Tours, pulled their advertising. Other small companies, including the Valdez Convention and Visitors Bureau, followed suit. The Alaska Tourism Marketing Council is reconsidering its advertising. Tom Dow, president of the Alaska Visitors Association, says he's concerned with the magazine covering news issues.
They've been very successful when they have stuck to their knitting over the years. They've been a very successful magazine in demonstrating kind of life on the last frontier, which is their byline, and human interest stories and travel stories and adventure stories.
But Ron Dalby says it's always been the magazine's policy to cover a major disaster that affects Alaska's natural resources. Almost exactly 25 years before the oil spill, Alaska Magazine scrapped an edition in order to cover the earthquake. Dalby says the magazine will continue that type of coverage, and it may actually pay off.
Alaska has gotten more ink and broadcast time in the last 2 months than any part of the country, save for Washington, D.C. More people are aware of us today than any other time in our history. They should be capitalizing on this, not necessarily trying to shoot the messengers.
Dalby says the ads pulled represent less than 1% of Alaska Magazine's gross income for the coming year. What it really relies on is sales and subscriptions.
We are 80% circulation driven, which is increasingly a rarity these days, I guess, in magazines. But 80% of our revenue comes from people who buy the magazine.
The total print order for the June magazine was 300,000. About 40,000 went to newsstands nationwide, and 200,000 or so went to subscribers. The subscription rate doesn't seem to be suffering because of the controversial issue.
I had one or two canceled subscriptions, but I probably, since the ruckus broke with the Tourism Council, I've probably taken 50 subscriptions.
Dalby says he's had many calls and letters from people in Alaska and outside, grateful for the coverage. The off-the-rack sales totals from the lower 48 won't be in for a while yet, but Dalby doesn't expect his major source of revenue to suffer because of an article about Prince William Sound.
We're proceeding as if, on this situation, as if there had not been the major spill. How would we have responded to this type of incident? And that's how we're going to respond.
We just received those results, and they show that that oil was not from the Exxon Valdez. It was light bunker crude.
It's a minor incident in a major incident, but and by itself, it's significant. When you're talking about putting a sheen, a 10-mile long sheen, 100 yards wide, that's a fair amount of oil. And if it was, if it had not been for the Exxon Valdez spill, there have been a number of individuals and organizations that would have been very upset over the size of the spill.
It's been a bad year for Chinook fishermen. Exxon Oil, which splattered the Alaskan Peninsula, already had forced closure of their eastern and central districts. On top of that, the early run of sockeye has been very weak. Although escapement past the Chinook Weir is close to making its goal, the harvest stood at just 59,000, a mere fraction of the expected 750,000 reds. A recent buildup of fish, however, allowed a second opening, a 24-hour period which began Monday morning. But Fish and Game had to cut it short. Biologist Mike Thompson says the fishery was closed halfway through the opening after oily moose was spotted in Chinook Bay. The abruptly closed period produced a catch of just 65,000 reds, valued at about $1.45 a pound. A second run of sockeye to Chinook should be beginning soon. Thompson says the state now will have to start making plans to deal with the oil if they're to catch the expected surplus of 700,000 reds. Fishing could be restricted to Chinook Lagoon, Thompson says, if it can be kept free of oil. He adds that a management plan similar to that used for oil-affected areas of Kodiak Island could be put in place. Right now, however, no formal decisions have been made, and at Chinook, once among the most lucrative salmon fisheries in the state, problems with Exxon Oil and a weak run have turned this into a season of uncertainty. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
An Exxon lawyer introduced him as the senior scientific scientist on the scene, Dr. Al Mackey. Mackey gave the commissioners an overview of what they're calling Exxon Valdez environmental studies. There's a long list of them, covering things like hydrocarbon distribution in Prince William Sound, herring studies, bird habitat, and sediment studies. But the commissioners seemed less concerned with what scientists are studying than who's paying for, analyzing, and given access to the information. Mackey is an employee of Exxon, but he says Exxon does not control the information generated by scientists in the field. According to Mackey, Exxon does not have proprietary control of the data. Towards the end of Mackey's testimony, Commissioner John Sun asked him what the purpose of the studies is. Why are they being done? Al Mackey answering questions from John Sun.
Well, since the first few days of the spill, you heard Exxon being republic in our desire to, we will respond to the spill and we will compensate for damages. These studies are indeed quantitatively and with a very solid science base, providing that quantitative assessment of what have been the effects and the impacts.
So basically the studies are for laying the groundwork for a damage assessment at a later date?
For assessment of the impacts, correct.
And that will be the basis for paying any damages that Exxon may be found liable for?
These data will define the level of impacts, right?
Coast Guard Admiral J. William Keim is the federal on-scene coordinator for the Exxon Valdez spill. He reported that cleanup is ahead of schedule, with some 90 miles of beach having been treated to the Coast Guard satisfaction. He added that those beaches will be reassessed. Keim says half of those are in Prince William Sound, and the figure represents over 10% of the beaches surveyed as oiled.
The question was asked, how clean is clean? Kime says their purpose is not to clean beaches or even to treat all beaches.
But what we're trying to do is stabilize the entire area of the spill, minimize the impact so that what work can't be done won't result in beaches that are going to cause problems for us next year, but will lead to work being done to actually complete the cleanup at that particular time. That's what we're trying to do. We could take 10 miles of beach and clean it so you could perform surgery on it, but that's not going to solve our problem.
Several of the commissioner's questions focused on preventing future spills. Kime doesn't think either increased tug escorts or double-hulled tankers will guarantee protection. In the case of tugs, he says if one were to try stopping a 200,000-ton tanker, chances are the tug would come out on the short end of the deal. He says increasing tug escorts won't buy as much safety as might be anticipated. The question of double hulls came up years ago. Kime says he was intimately involved in discussions at that time. According to him, double hull construction might have reduced the initial spill from the Exxon Valdez. However, the result could have been worse.
Let's take, I think there's no question that if the Exxon Valdez had grounded and opened up the same amount of the hull as was opened up in this accident, the amount of oil leaking out would have been reduced by about 50%. However, in building a ship, when you build double bottoms, the bottom plating is thinner, the structure is different, and we also, probably with equal probability, could have had the Exxon Valdez absorb less energy going across the reef, maybe could have opened the engine room up, lost the whole thing, and we'd have had a 52 million gallon spill.
Though double hulls are being reconsidered as a result of the Exxon Valdez spill, Kime says most maritime casualties are due to human error, and addressing tanker construction is not the best approach. Kime says if a 747 flies into a mountain, the response isn't to try and build one that will bounce off next time. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
The loss in wages didn't start with the salmon season. It started way back in April when black cod boats chose not to fish and instead hired on with Exxon for cleanup. The downturn at the processing plants continued when oil shut down portions of the herring fishery. Now it's salmon season, when workers commonly get 80 to 100 hours a week. This year, the plant employees are lucky to be getting 40 hours a week. That's a severe loss of income for people like Mrs. Malutak.
Pag may salmon, pag busy kami, two weeks lang, 1,000 something.
Yeah, in salmon times, according to her, her words, they said, oh, during salmon time, every 2 weeks, they said 1,400.
Yeah, the gross.
For 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks.
Now she made only for 2 weeks around 400. Because of a slowdown, you know, it's too slow.
You can see the difference. It's the difference.
One third. She feels bad and worried, you know, and she cannot sleep.
Malutak has worked at one local plant for the past 13 years. She has 9 children and usually sends several hundred dollars a month to her mother in the Philippines. She's getting unemployment insurance, but says it's far less money than she could get working. Her son Romeo applied for a job with Vico over 2 months ago. He went through safety training and hasn't heard from them since. Romeo also looked into filing a claim with Exxon.
We came from the Exxon claim office. They just give us form to be filled up, one for the employer and one for the employee. And then we will have submitted over there. And then they said they'll just give us a call or something else.
They didn't tell you when?
No, they didn't tell anything about when they will give us the money or the people
just
will
file
just file the form and then we don't know when they will be processed. Or,
many say the claims process goes too slowly and what they need is immediate financial help. Several hundred workers gathered this weekend to discuss the matter with an Exxon representative. Lorenzo Sabato asked the one question on everyone's minds.
We are aware that from now on, since the beginning of the opening of the salmon season, we have no much fish to work on, the salmon that's coming in. I, for one, have been working for 3 days with only 6 hours and 30 minutes for 3 days. Now, I am losing wages. And for those who have children in school, naturally have no money to spend. What I am asking now is, If this case is going on up to the end of the salmon season, then practically we have no money as a result of the oil spill problem. How are we going to be compensated for that? And what is the mode of payment and when?
Exxon representative John Peavy suggested setting up a task force. So seven plant managers and five employee representatives met to design a proposal. They're asking Exxon to make an immediate minimum payment for wages lost during April, May, and June. A worker's hours over the past 3 years would be average to use for comparison. After the first payment, the task force suggests Exxon make reimbursements on a monthly basis. The proposal now goes to Exxon officials in Valdez for review. In the meantime, plant managers are drawing up lists of their employees and detailing which ones have lost work. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Who is responsible for the Exxon Valdez oil spill? Do you think Joseph Hazelwood is guilty? What should be his punishment? Do you think Hazelwood can get a fair trial in Valdez? If you live in Valdez, Anchorage, or Fairbanks, you may have been asked such questions over the telephone. Dittman Research, an Anchorage-based organization that performs public opinion polls, has been conducting a survey. Dittman's Lisa Bullion says they plan to continue the survey through the end of the week. She would neither say for whom the survey is being conducted nor to what end. Joseph Hazelwood was the captain of the Exxon Valdez, master of the vessel when it grounded on Bly Reef March 24th. Hazelwood's trial is currently set to take place in Valdez in spite of motions from Hazelwood's attorney to move it. Paulette Foster of the District Attorney's Office in Anchorage says further motions to change the site of the trial are not out of the question. She says that survey results could conceivably be used to support such a motion. Hazelwood has pled not guilty to felony and misdemeanor charges in connection with the Exxon Valdez oil spill. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.